to me, it's not acceptable that Portland is such a great place and we really stink as a place for people of color.
The whole concept of white privilege is not that you yourself are doing something bad, but you have to look at, are you still continuing to go to the bank of unearned privilege and cash your check, which really belongs to all of us and not just one particular group? Because if you continue to cash that check, then you are benefiting at my expense or any other person of color's expense in this city.
Celeste Carey and Judith Mowry are co-founders of the Restorative Listening Project. The Restorative Listening Project is a monthly forum that uses storytelling to create a greater understanding of gentrification in North and Northeast Portland. The Restorative Listening Project is based on the principles of restorative justice, which says that only when those most impacted are heard, acknowledged, and efforts have been made to repair the harm, can the community be made whole again. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll listen to an interview with Celeste Carey and Judith Mowry, recorded at the Voices of Portland event hosted by the Dill Pickle Club. Stay tuned.
This interview was conducted by Arlie Summer on May 26, 2011. We begin with Celeste Carey explaining how the Restorative Listening Project is structured.
The first thing we do is wonder how we're going to get guests to come and who's going to be the next guest speaker. The reason I put it that way is because so many people have left the area and it's hard to get in touch with folks. Lives and systems of living have changed. And so some people don't have the ability to get wherever we're going to be. And we made a commitment to focus on having the actual physical location in Northeast Portland. So after we get through with that major trauma, then we try to have two, maybe three guest speakers come and sit down and tell their stories. And we invite people to come and fill the room, pretty much like we've done tonight.
So we hear people's story, and the reason it's called the Restorative Listening Project is because we base this on some of the principles of restorative justice. One of the things that restorative justice says is that those who are harmed best understand the harm. What we knew was there was a huge amount of, I guess I would call it relational angst in the community. We knew through our own work and our third partner John Canda's work that African Americans in the community were feeling large amounts of grief, alienation, mourning for the community that they had had, and shock at the change in the community. A lot of white folks were moving in, and I was working as a mediator at that time, and I would get calls saying, you know, I love the diversity in the neighborhood and I'm not a racist, but, you know, there's a lot of activity at my neighbor's house. They're black and I think there's drug dealing. So we recognized that there was a huge cultural gulf and that really there was a mourning community, and there were a lot of folks who had moved in who I really believed were well-intentioned but blind to the impact that they were making on the neighbors that have been here prior to them.
Okay, so you came together to start this. I'm really interested in your background too. I think it's an important thing to lay out before we get more into the rest of the project. Judith, your parents, you were raised in a religious home, and your father was a minister and very involved in the civil rights movement. And Celeste, you've moved around quite a bit and experienced. If you could talk about your childhood, Judith, I'm really, I wish you would share about that.
My dad was a Presbyterian minister, and my parents got very involved with the civil rights movement. He was the minister at a little church outside of Pittsburgh. Most of the congregation were mining families, Polish descent mining families. But when Dr. King wrote his letter from the Birmingham jail and called on other pastors to come and assist, my father felt that call. I've grown to learn that that was very controversial in my family. So as a little girl, I was really told that this was the most important issue of life. And I was very lucky because my parents' whole thing was around religion or God, and Jesus was, it's all about love and social justice, and that this is really why we were here. So that really exposed me to a lot of stuff. We moved into Pittsburgh. I lived in a neighborhood where All of my closest friends were African American. It was an unusually integrated neighborhood in Pittsburgh. I didn't even realize till last year when my sister pointed this out to me. I'm now doing work on gentrification, but one of the great sorrows of my life was when, within about a four-month period, all of my closest friends moved because we were gentrifying. And so suddenly all of my black friends were gone and moved to a part of Pittsburgh called The Hill, where I was also really shocked and saddened to find out that when my friends said, you can't come here because you're white. So it's sort of been a lifelong thing. And when I landed in Oregon, I was really surprised about how few people of color I encountered. And I know a lot of people think gentrification just happened here, but I bought my house 25 years ago, and I knew families who were buying houses closer and closer into Northeast. I had a terrible dilemma about it because I really wanted my kids to live in a more diverse place than most of Portland, but I was really concerned about being a gentrifier, and I ended up deciding not to move into the neighborhood, but to really work at establishing relationships and community with the neighborhood.
What were your first impressions, Celeste, coming to Portland? You moved here in
1988. November, I want to say 6th. I transferred up here with my job. I visited Portland. I visited the Northwest. I traveled a lot. I lived in Kansas. I had a friend who worked on my staff. I was a nurse. I was a charge nurse. Vern used to say, oh, you'll love Portland. It's on a river, just like little beautiful Lawrence, Kansas. And it's a wonderful arts community, and you're such a fabulous photographer. You should be there. You should be there. The whales, everything. And so, you know, he kind of had me hooked. And I thought, yes. And so I decided after traveling around and looking at cities that I'd give it a shot. Vern had moved here, and he had changed his name, and he had reacclimated to the Northwest, and I moved out here and I visited and I thought, yeah, I can make this work. And then I came in and I moved less than a year later. I experienced a culture shock. Now, I grew up in a big city, so Portland probably will never be what I consider a big city. But it's comfortable. I mean, you can get lost sometimes and you can discover things, and it has an influx of culture and interesting and enriching activities all the time. But what I expected was something kind of like what I had encountered when I lived in San Francisco, a heightened awareness of how we all as people are connected, and a kind of synchronicity, a kind of synergy. I didn't find that here. What I found was a kind of segregation. It floored me. I had lived and traveled all around this country. I grew up in the Midwest. I did not grow up in the South, but I knew what segregation was all about. I knew what real bigotry and discrimination and racism was all about because I went to a Jesuit college and I was one of the only two blacks in honors, and I had to run the daily gauntlet of being told, you don't belong here. So I understood institutional racism because they told me, well, we don't intend for you to succeed. So my thought was, okay, I must be not properly calibrated. I must be seeing something. This can't be Portland because this is 1988 and we are all enlightened. I talked to my friend. I said, Mikhail, because he changed his name because he was in the Northwest. What's going on here? I'm having some culture shock. He says, what? I said, come to the store with me. So we lived off of 74th and Oregon. That's where I was staying. We went up to Keno's. We stood up there at the little lovely bakery place. And we stood. And we stood. And we stood. So about 15 minutes later, he's starting to look at me all crazy and agitated, like, what are you doing? I said, I'm waiting to be served. I told him, go around the corner there. Just walk around like you've seen something you want. And then give the woman an expectant look. And he did. And he got waited on immediately. And I'm still standing there. And I'm still standing there. And after a while, I decided, okay, I'm going to leave because I want to take him someplace else. In the course of our doing that for the next couple of weeks, we visited Nordstrom's. We went to Safeway. We went to a little charming place to eat steak. We went a lot of different places, and the common thing was I was not getting waited on. And he was in shock because he just did not think it would happen. And he felt personally responsible because he had invited me here. I explained to him, I said, well, I understand now, because it would look beautiful to you, because you are a 6'2", blonde, blue-eyed white guy. You're not me.
So you're experiencing a different Portland. And I was really, I mean, that was my experience. It was culture shock from the beginning. And sadly, it has not changed as much as it should have for us to be in 2011. It hasn't. Even though this sometimes is the worst place in the world for me to be, it has also been the best place for me. Because anybody who's ever heard the expression, iron sharpens iron, it means that when you are in adversity, you become sharpened. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, well, I already have a certain level of, I don't know, I guess the correct phrase, you know, the proper phrase would be piss and vinegar. So why not, you know? And I stayed because I was needed and there were things that I mm-hmm. had to do. And as hard as it became, and it is still hard to this day. I sit up sometimes, I was actually having a conversation with Judith today. It's like, some days I feel like I'm losing my mind, but I'm here because there were things to do, like this.
So you started working for the Office of Crime Prevention, mm-hmm. and you met Judith because Judith was a mediator.
Well, we actually met each other beforehand. I used to run a federal program through the Department of Justice called Weed and Seed. It is a combination law enforcement and community development program that came out of the Bush Elder administration. It's one of the few things that came out of a Republican administration, new, modern Republican administration, that actually did a lot of good in the community. You know, if it was applied good, it did a lot of good. And so Judith and I were housed in the same building. You were over in the Mediation Center, and I was working over in the Northeast Coalition office.
So Celeste and I would, you know, talk about stuff. We were finding really everywhere, every predominantly Black church, community center, and individuals were feeling like they were almost under attack. City complaints were coming in. And this, I mean, this was just happening in an extreme way. You know, people would come in, buy a house next to a church, and then be really upset that, you know, there was loud music and parking on a Sunday morning.
Clapping at children. What is that all about?
Right. It was really pretty stunning. And some of it was really appallingly obvious, and some of it was just really, people were baffled by this. My experience is that for a lot of white folks, we're raised thinking diversity is a good thing, but a lot of people had never lived around people who were different than they were. And they came in with what, you know, we call white privilege, saying, oh, this is great, and we'll all behave like we do. And if you behave any different, well, we'll just help you know how to, you know, improve your community. But Celeste and I began talking about it. We worked on a project together because it was a church that was predominantly Black, that was doing some social service work. And Celeste was working with the neighbors and trying to help them get organized. Crime Prevention has some wonderful tools for getting together, and the neighbors were concerned because these, you know, dodgy people would be in their neighborhood. And Celeste had an experience that was repeated, which is folks would work with her until she would talk about the fact that these other folks were people, had been here, let's work together, there's a way that we can all kind of figure something out. And then they'd stop returning her calls or let her know that, you know, we really appreciate your help, but we feel like you've got sort of your own agenda.
Yeah.
Celeste told me the stories, and then I firsthand experienced the stories of being with people and saying, oh, well, thank you so much. You know, Celeste is great, but she's got an agenda. Which pretty soon I realized, you know, she's Black. And so she is not going to understand us or our needs.
I couldn't possibly understand and serve their needs, no.
Yeah. So Celeste and I became friends, and we became allies in getting the work done, because sadly, I could go in and say exactly what Celeste had said and ask people to work with me exactly as Celeste did, and they would just be all ready to go. So,
as a matter of fact, that was how we did it. We actually tag teamed. I had one neighborhood group, and they had an issue with an affordable housing group. They wanted the woman removed. I said, okay, if I get her removed, understand that if the overarching principle of this group is to get people in with housing, what we really want to do is look at what kind of support you give a person in this house to make sure that their needs are being met and that they have some idea of how to work with you for a common vision of community. Not your vision, not their vision, but a common vision. Well, they didn't like that idea. And I said, but no, stop. Listen, because if you get her kicked out, they'll send somebody else. This person may have the same ideas. So why don't we just have a kumbaya moment and actually work this out? They didn't like that. Mm-hmm. They said, oh, she has an agenda. So I was trying to finish doing the work. Judith gives me a call. She says, you know, these people called me, and it sounds like it's in one of your neighborhoods, and I want to tell you what they want, and see if you can give me a little backstory on this, because they need some contact with this housing group. And I said, oh, housing group? Where are these people? She told me, I said, oh, yeah, I tell you what. I'm not going to give you any story. I want you to go in there and handle this. And as soon as you get to the point of what you can do, I know already, because we worked together by then, I said, I already know what you're going to say. Just handle it. Sure enough, she tells them exactly the same thing. And I said, okay, this is what we're going to do from now on. When I have a group that doesn't want to listen to me, I'm going to send you in. And if we have a group that's really big, then we'll both go together, and I'll be the little colored woman in the corner. And you just do what I hear. Let me show you what I need you to do, and you do this, and we'll see what happens. And sure enough, it worked every time. And that's when we realized we need to really change how this community thinks and operates and processes. Because even though we might have a success in getting the point across and bringing folks together, you can imagine how that made me feel. Mm-hmm. Not just as a city person, a staff working on your tax dollar, but as a human being, you're telling me that I really don't matter. And I thought, gee, not only do I have to listen to you tell me both overtly and covertly how much I don't matter, but you know, in my personal life, when I go out, well, I still probably am not going to get waited on. So where is the wonderful city for me?
That was Celeste Carey. We now go to audio from a restorative listening session.
Nani Kaz is a longtime Portland resident that shares her story with us about growing up in Northeast Portland and her reasons for returning to her old neighborhood.
When I lived there, I remember playing, I don't know when y'all, how old you guys are, but we used to play a game called hide and seek, right? So we all go behind the pole, count to 20, and everybody disappeared, right? Well, the only thing you had to hide behind was parked cars and bushes and an alley and things like that, because we didn't have fences. We could run through your yard and my yard and your yard, and all still be within a block or so away from each other, so we could run and tag each other. I know this was a thing in my community. When the street lights came on, somebody better know where you is. Like, you got to be real close to home. So the rule in our neighborhood is you could go within two blocks of your house. Because when Mr. Allen stood outside and whistled, you could hear him from two blocks, and everybody would be saying, oh, Gail, Barbara, you guys better get home, your daddy calling you. So those are my memories of growing up as a child. And then something happened, and I remember probably it was like 69 or 68. We had to get on a bus. I see one of my bus aides here, and she was one of my angels, because I remember riding that bus, and there were probably 30 of us that got on that bus, and we went way across town. And we went over to Northwest Portland, because they said it was better schools over there, and we would get a better education. It was traumatizing to leave my home, to walk to my neighborhood school, to get on the bus, because some of my friends got to stay at school, and some of us had to get on the bus. And we knew that we didn't belong there, we didn't look like them, they didn't look like us, but you know, we did what we had to do. And as a result of that, we were told that naturally the dominant culture was better and white was right, right? So, you know, you get these messages as kids, and you know, life goes on. So we get through school, and I decide that I need to move. I get married, and I have these four sons, and I'm raising them over here. People are like, no, no, don't raise them over in that community. They're going to go bad. You need to go over to Southeast. So I run and go buy me a house over there. And I'm going to say two things, and I'm going to bring it back when I'm back in this community. Is I bought a house out in Southeast Portland on 72nd Blayvale back in 88. bought a 4-bedroom house, beautiful. I paid, you know, quite a bit of money down on it, me and my husband. And my son got chased home by skinheads. I was scared for my children to play outside for the fear that they would get hurt just because of the color of their skin. You know, they would go to school and say, Mom, ain't no black kids. And I say, uh-huh, they there. You just got to go, keep going. They gonna come. And for years, there weren't any. And I realized at some point it was scarier to be there than it was to be here. And if I had to take my chances, I was gonna raise my baby with people who looked like them that weren't gonna hurt them just because of who they were. So my mother was getting old and older, and my children were going off to college. And so, you know, I'm probably your typical textbook kind of off the beat mom, you know, raised kids, football, basketball, all the hoopla, and came back into this community. Now, I'm going to tell you, I was part of the damage of this community. When the drugs came in and the violence came in and all that, I'm also a recovering addict. You know, when I was out there smoking crack and doing all those horrible things that helped this neighborhood run down. And I knew it was my responsibility when I got clean 18 years ago to get back over here and help build it back up. And so today I come and I look around and I have sadness in my heart, sadness. I want to tell this one story because it's so funny. When we moved back over here in like 2000, I was sitting on the porch. I came and I only had my youngest son with me because the other boys were off to college and doing their thing. And I brought my little TV out and set it on a chair. I have a little Coke and everything. I'm sitting up on the porch and I turned on TV and my son came home. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm watching TV because I'm in the house." I said, "We used to do it all the time." He said, "Mom, you're the only person out here." I said, "I can't be. It was only like 9:30, 10 o'clock. And I stood up and I looked around and there were no people. There were no children outside playing kickball or hide and seek. There were no adults outside. It was just still. He said, "Mom, you need to go in the house." I was like, "Oh my God, like what has happened?" And that's when I first started to notice the change in the neighborhood. Now I've been living back in that house for 8 years. I don't even talk to my neighbors because my neighbors don't talk to me. I have never been I guess it's dishonored when my mother, who's like 75, out in the yard picking stuff, the people don't talk to her. It's like a respect thing. Like we were taught, I would never walk by somebody that I thought was older than me and not give them the respect. The people in my neighborhood, we don't talk to each other. They talk to themselves, but they don't talk to us. And it's almost like it feels like we're inconvenience. Like, you were here, yes, we know you were here, but we're here, and I ain't talking about none of y'all. I told this lady over here, sometimes things fall out my mouth, and they really don't mean no harm, and don't take nothing real personal, because it ain't got nothing to do with you. It's about the way I feel and the way I see, and that's it. And I don't know none of you, and none of you know me, so don't take it personal. But what I feel is like this total disrespect. I remember, I'm in the Boise Elliott neighborhood. Is anybody in that association? Anybody in here? I went to this 3 times. And the first time I was there, it was really cold. It was this younger, kind of upbeat, kind of crowd of people that just kind of were different. They reminded me of people that were on Hawthorne. But I'm okay, because I can get along with people from the crack house to the White House. So, you know, I have those skills. But when I left out of there, I wanted to treat them like I was in the crack house. Because of the way they were talking about them people and those kids. Those kids stay out too late. and they're just roaming around the streets. And we should, they had the Portland police there. They wanted a curfew on them kids. And I thought about, whose kids you talking about? They was talking about my kids. Kids that look like my kids. And they just happened to be dark-skinned with big baggy pants and shirts on backwards, and they like to listen to loud music. And they used to like hollering at each other and what's up? And for some reason, they didn't want them kids in their neighborhood. And I thought, how dare you? You know, because they wanted to walk their dogs at Unthank Park. And our kids wanted to shoot ball at Unthank Park in the middle of the night. And those two things couldn't coexist. So the kids needed to leave and have a curfew. That was the first time. And I thought, okay, Tony, you can be a big girl and you can go back. So I did, because I want to be a good neighbor now. I went back the second time. And they started to talk about the dogs. They all got pit bulls, and I don't think that they should have them kind of dogs around here, and our kids are scared, and blah, blah. And I thought, you know what, I'm done. I asked this lady, I said, how long have you lived in this neighborhood? She said, 4 years. I said, I've been here 40. And they nan dog bit me around here. And the reason that I'm really here today, to tell the truth, is I came to one of these, I think it was the second one, and I talked about that front page article in the Oregonian about the Miracles Club that's down the street here for recovering addicts and alcoholics. And the woman that lived diagonal from the club that had been there 10 plus years, I've been going to Miracles for the last 16 years that has been in the community, that helps save lives and make people, drug addicts, out of productive members of society and teaches us how to get along. She said in that article, I thought this was wrong. I thought this is, people used to think stuff. But now they say it, and when you say it, to me, something's different. She said they didn't belong there. This was a residential neighborhood now. And that those kind of people shouldn't be there. They should be somewhere else. And that it was a good thing that they were doing it, that, you know, helping those people out. But they shouldn't be in the community. And she said it was a cultural thing. She said, because where she came from, people didn't blast their music like that. And people didn't roll down their windows and holler at each other and talk to each other across the street. She said, and she just thought it was an entitlement issue. And when that happened, I said, this is, and then I sat in that room and I said that. And a lady got with Judith and said, we were one of the people that fought to keep this alive, and we fought for Miracles, and we're on their side, and blah, 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 this. And you know what happened to me then? I thought, why didn't you come talk to me? Am I that scary? Do I look that bad? Do I look like I want to jump on you? I mean, like, I can have an intellectual conversation. And I'm more than willing to talk to anybody. I think I have one of the most unconditional, loving souls that I know of. And yeah, I mean, but really, when has it become that we can't talk to each other? Whether we're black, white, green, blue, 16, 18, 28, or 88. That's right. If I can't come to my neighbor, or I can't come to you as a person and let you know how I feel, something is wrong. Mm-hmm. It definitely is. We have all lived together on this planet. We've all lived in Northeast Portland. We've been all over. What is it that's going on right now that we're scared of one another? Because that's what I feel. I feel my neighbors are scared of me. And you know what? I'm kind of scared of them too. They look like, you know, they don't look like me. You know, so naturally, you know, I have some fears. But I talk to Mike now. Mike's pretty cool. I learned he was a jazz musician. And now me and Mike talk. Because, you know, I want Mike to look out for my house while I'm on vacation. I've got an RV sitting in the back. When my dog start barking, I want Mike to look out his window and see if anybody breaking in my RV. I want Mike to know he can go on vacation, and if I see somebody lurking around in his backyard, that I'm gonna call the police or I'm gonna figure it out. But it don't make no sense that we live next to each other and we can't even talk to one another. Kids don't play with one another. Something is wrong. And I don't think it's a race thing. I think we have a cultural thing that's going on, and this is my opinion, only my opinion. I think we have some sort of cultural thing that is happening in Northeast Portland and people don't know how to deal with it. I believe younger white people have come into the community and want to live in a diverse community, but you ain't never been around black folks. So then they go like, oh my God, you know, they didn't expect this, so they clean together. And then we think, oh my God, they're clinging together. They're coming to get us. So we don't want to talk to y'all later. But that's my opinion, guys. This does not reflect. I don't know. But I know something's got to give. And I know that things have to be torn down before they're built up. And I hope through this process, we tear down the myths and we build a community up. Because you know what? Some of us ain't going nowhere. Ain't that what we said? We ain't going nowhere. I know your parents ain't going nowhere. No, we ain't going nowhere. I'm building another house in the back of my house so I can bring my grandkids there. You know, and I'm quite sure that some of you guys have liked this community. And I'm quite sure you ain't going nowhere. So let's figure this out together. So I'm done. I've said my little stories.
That was Nani Cox, a Portland resident, who shared her experiences with us about living in Portland.
I realize now it's sort of one of those things, you start something because you have to do something, and it's the thing that makes sense to do at the time. Later, as I realized, we have captured an oral history, and an oral history that's not just about events, but about impacts and how it makes people feel. And in Portland, you have to understand that the dislocation of the black community here was a loss beyond any other community. People say, well, you know, gentrification's about class too. And it is, but if you're a poor white person and you get moved out of your neighborhood, you can move to a lot of other neighborhoods where you are around white people predominantly. This was the only place that there was a community that looked, you know, you could walk down the street and know that you were in your community. And I've had so many people tell me how important that was to them and how meaningful that was to them. It was a loss that, as I began to see it more and more clearly, became more and more stunning. Now, we've done this for 3 years. We've had 26 sessions. Almost all of them have been taped, filmed by Flying Focus Video Collective.
Yay, Flying Focus.
And if you are interested, they have produced some of them. And you can see some of them. Already, Mr. Charles Ford, who was one of our speakers, passed. He passed last year. So that was something we could have lost. I really hope eventually we will be able to pull together and actually edit them all and make a series and have the stories captured. I think the stories are so provocative. You know, I knew that for white folks, where do we go if we want to learn about this?
That was Judith Mowry of the Restorative Listening Project. You are listening to Circle A Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Tonight, we're listening to an interview with Celeste Carey and Judith Mowry of the Restorative Listening Project that was conducted by Arlie Summer for the Dill Pickle Club on May 26, 2011. Again, this is Judith Mowry.
The storytelling makes us feel connected to each other. It's a way that people feel. It's been a very powerful vehicle for what we've been trying to accomplish, which is a conversation.
It really has, because what happened was you had people who had never been heard. Mm-hmm. They would get up and tell their story. Mm-hmm. They would share everything from just the mundane aspects to what it was like to be politically involved. They would be able to share their story without somebody demanding validation or demanding proof or wanting to interrupt and interpret it. Mm-hmm. They were able to just share their human experience. And the remarkable thing about it was that as people listened, even if at first there was this wall, this filter, and we all have one, we all do, you know, it's just our human experience. But even if there was this, there was so much real emotion in that telling of the story that you could not help but resonate. Mm-hmm. As human beings, we ignore the fact that viscerally we do respond to things. You know, we don't want to act like we have that capacity. But the hearing of these stories would make you respond. One of our people told the story of being in Unthanked Park during the time when the city had ceased to invest in this area, and the swing set was in horrible state of repair. And the parents would not let the kids go and swing on it because it would swing up and it would come loose from its moorings. The thought was, don't go over there and swing it because you could get hurt. And one girl did. And the person telling the story was not only a teacher in that neighborhood at that very site, but it was her friend who had died on that swing set decades earlier. And so it was profound to have that kind of emotion be shared, because we all know that there's a certain level of response that we don't question. We know it's genuine. We know that something has happened, and we know that we must do something to make that right.
And I think the storytelling sort of helped reveal the disinvestment. Mm-hmm. People will say, well, you know, things change, and well, economic times change, and who could have helped it? Well, there was a lot that could be done differently. That became clear. And the other part of that story was that parents had been calling downtown saying, you need to come. You need to come and repair this playground equipment. This was a city park. Mm-hmm. One person said to me, you know, it's so weird because you white people, like, you don't come over and talk to us. You just call the police. You know, if our music's too loud, you don't come knock on the door. And I said, oh, well, we do that to each other, too. So I hate to inform you that we tend to do that. But the really stunning thing is, she said, when I realized the sort of the extra wound of, she said, the white people move in, my music's too loud, they call the police, and they come. This was a place where within 5 years earlier, they would call the police and say, there are shots being fired. We are on the floor of our living room. Our lives are in danger. The police would never come.
Not good.
So you modeled your storytelling program after victim offender mediation?
Yeah, my passion's always been about getting people, let's have a conversation. You know, that I really believe that we can improve the world by being in a deeper dialogue with each other. To me, it's not acceptable that Portland is such a great place and we really stink as a place for people of color. And there's been more and more stuff that's come out around that. We're just this community of amazing, smart, socially responsible, creative folks. I think we could just not only figure this out, but we could do something so innovative around it. And it's so painful to watch. I began to think about it. I was the manager of a restorative justice program at Multnomah County for juveniles, and it was a victim offender mediation program. And I started to think, you know, what if racism was a victim offender mediation? What if I was the mediator and they called me and said, we have racism and you need to bring these parties together and do this? What would be needed? And the great thing about restorative justice is it addresses the past. I think we are so hesitant to allow there to be a past or even a current time that is very deep. We have, and I like, Celeste, how you talked about, you have the good and you have the bad simultaneously. There are paradoxes. It's so hard for us sometimes to just acknowledge harm and to just say, oh, okay, I see that there's harm. And there's goodwill. For me, it was surprising how much people in the Black community felt like white people are completely aware of what they're doing and they just don't care enough to change any of it. Because that wasn't my experience, because I was a blind white person. So the restorative justice, really one of the things about that too is that people become accountable. So the people who have been harmed get to name what that harm is. Then the people who have harmed, and believe me, we all continue to perpetuate the harm if we don't become active in changing the way the system works and changing even our own personal behavior. Those people become accountable. Once you have accountable folks, then you can come together and say, let's have a real conversation about the harm and how we build the future together that's different. But, you know, in a lot of conversations, white people will say, I know it's terrible, all that stuff. And of course, I didn't own slaves, but it's awful that happened to your people. And it's great. We're all here now. So what are we going to do together to get in the future? And why can't they get off the dime about the past? That has been a huge barrier, and I've seen it repeated again and again and again. And so it's like, no, we can't get off the dime about the past because you do not understand it yet. And you do not understand how it gets replicated again and again and again. Okay. So if you listen and you start to get it, and then I believe that you understand it, and I believe that you really want to be accountable to making it different, then maybe we can start to talk about the community we're building together.
That was Judith Mowry. Next, we hear an excerpt from an interview with Portland resident Pastor Don Frazier, who shares his own experiences of moving to Portland and the gentrification and displacement that occurred after the Vanport flood.
I was born and raised in Portland. My parents came from Arkansas and were told to go past Portland and move, find a place in Vancouver. And they were looking for a place to, they were coming to work in the shipyards. And my dad retired from the shipyards before he passed. Yeah. For me, we had a very strong family, a very strong father, which I think we, in many families, are missing today, that type of leadership in our homes. I lived on Moore Street, right across the street from Dawson Park. And at that time, there's a parade of prostitutes going up and down the street ever since I can remember, since I was 5 years old, that used to talk to me when I was a kid. Also, walking through those alleyways, seeing dope mixed with blood into some of the arms of men and women, people drinking all night long and fighting, and sometimes having to walk my mother home in order so she would not be harassed, and standing up to men that were a lot bigger than me to protect my mother. And it was so that, it just kind of, it was there. It was always intense. The winos that broke in our football games and wanted to play. And it was all that kind of a lifestyle. It was fun, but very scary, very scary. And but yet, with a strong family, we were able to maintain. So we had that's what got us through, the strength of the family. You know, there were people of a few words. They just did what they were doing and got us focused at home. It was easy to figure out what was going on ourselves. We didn't need a whole lot of explanation. It was pretty stark. But what they modeled was good work ethics. Mom made sure that we went to church, Vancouver First Baptist Church, with a wool suit on that was hot as heck. And that I used to itch haul the whole entire service. And sometimes I would go to church with my friends around the corner who happened to be white, who went to Immaculate Heart. And I went to Mass because it was out real soon. I had a choice. When I wanted to cut it short, I was Catholic. When I wanted to be long, I'd be a Baptist. Well, I think people need to understand that those things that you grow up in are very strongly influence you. They become your own demons that you have to find your way to work out and find ways to work out. And being in something, and I can also become a part of who you are. So that explained the very wild lifestyle later on in my own life. And also seeing how those streets affected people also made me take a different stand at some point. I lost two sisters because of dope in that community, who died at a very early age because of heroin. Mm-hmm. So when you grow up in that kind of environment, you try to find ways to fight back. You try to find ways to make sure that your family is going to be secure and safe, and make sure that you're protecting what's yours. And also just trying to stand for right. It's not difficult to stand for right. And it wasn't black or white, it was just right or wrong. I mean, we were all just one friends, brothers. And, you know, you hear them talk, he sounds more black than I do, you know, because he was immersed in that community. And I was, we became friends, and when people came in who wanted to beat them up because they're white, we just kept fighting until there was no one left. And it wasn't as intense until around the late to mid-60s. Families accepted each other for who they were. and families supported one another and wasn't the type of overt racism that you see here in that, in those communities. People kind of stood with each other. I think what we had going, Portland has a pretty racist history. Some of that stuff was just going underneath the current. Say, for instance, Mount Olivet Baptist Church, the lumber that was brought over to build that church were brought by the Klan. And those folks were active in those communities. But around 60, in the early 60s and mid 60s, people didn't do much of anything to get on each other's nerves until those first gentrification things began to happen, projects began to happen in the community. First of all, Emmanuel Hospital, where families were moved out and dispersed. And before you know it, people are down. Then here comes the Fremont Bridge, and people are down with houses, and before you know it, they hear a freeway going over their head. And no one had informed them, no one had talked to them. They were just moved around like cattle. That's when I think things begin to happen, when the riots begin to happen here in Northeast Portland. People were, I remember seeing people throwing bricks at cars as they came down the street. Every time they saw a white family, they would throw bricks and sticks and whatever else. People were angry because they were pent up. And they say, why do you burn your own neighborhood down? Well, it wasn't their houses, they were renting. You know, and people just were not given, and that redlining was going on then, the same way it happens to the next step at Lloyd Center, where that gentrification thing began to happen. And then the next step is Alberta Street. That began to happen. And when you displace people and they're not considered as to who they are and valued, people are going to get upset. Can you think of any other neighborhood where people, the city just comes in and just moves you out? You won't find a neighborhood like this. Something wrong with that. I think it has happened consistently the way it has in the past and up to the future. Things just happen. No one has the time to react, plan, or respond to it. The organization now that buys up property for the city now, what is that,
PDC?
CDC. Same thing. They buy property and then later on they tell you it's there. You know, that you never know it's for sale. Those things have been happening for years. There's no indication that I've ever seen of the city trying to get our people involved in the process. Only when they want to move something, they may have some urban renewal thing where they get a few blacks on there to say, to represent, and then they go along with their plan anyway. And those blacks don't have influence anyway. The same thing happened when we were, as pastors, we were invited to come and hear what was gonna happen in the building. Saying these people are gonna be displaced and you're gonna see people out further east. Not knowing that the same thing was occurring here in Northeast, but we should have been wise once the gang influence got here and the property price went down. And then they moved the police into the neighborhood, so cleaning the neighborhood up. And then the property's dirt cheap. And now here comes the pioneers coming in to do entrepreneur and buy cheap property while the community that had one time had an identity has been displaced. There was so much redlining is pathetic. Well, there was no opportunity. People from outside the community had those opportunities. Builders had opportunities to find funding. But black community, you know, it's been consistent all through the years. You're not gonna be given that opportunity to get a loan or anything like that. So we just moved over. And those young people were coming in here, and you can see in the planning, there was no thought of this community. When you see the very restaurants that come in here, you know, ain't too many black folks vegetarian, okay? You have the restaurants, you have all of the different shops, and there was no dialogue with community. And then there's no sensitivity to community when people move in. These young upstarts, very proud, financially capable people, don't really have much to say to these people who have been more traditional here in the community. I'm an adjunct professor at Multnomah Seminary, and my students actually do a cultural map up and down Alberta. They interview the pioneers, they interview the traditional people,
and the shops and the restaurants. They've been doing this for 7 or 8 years, and they give me their report at the end of that time, that term, that has pretty in-depth interviews. What these business owners feel, and most of the time they don't have a clue what the community feels. They're not bad people; they just don't know. I think if you identify people in communities, business people, community leaders, let me back up a minute. I don't want to say community leaders. I would like to see the people who are grassroots. I think people are grown; they can speak for themselves. And I think they need an opportunity to speak. And sometimes we can get sometimes misrepresented by leaders too. I was in that responsibility as a leader and as a social worker for a while, and bringing programs here to the community. And I know how things can change real quickly. And word never really gets back to the people who really need to hear. I would identify those people in the community, the pioneers, as well as those people on the traditional side, and give them an invitation to open up and dialogue and talk about what the real issues is. And anytime you want to break barriers down and do some healing, I think only people can only change in the context of relationship. If you don't know me, you don't know my heart, you'll never know what my concerns are, my issues are. And I don't know how much setting things we have in common if we never have a conversation. And I think that's the whole thing with blacks and whites. We don't dialogue enough. And I think if you have that dialogue going, you can probably come up with a plan of how to go through a healing process and work together.
That was an excerpt from a speech given by Pastor Don Frazier, a Portland resident and community activist. We now go back to the interview conducted by Arlie Summer for the Dill Pickle Club. This is Celeste Carey of the Restorative Listening Project.
I get a little frustrated because people will continue to say, what could we do? And I say, okay, you've been coming to this and listening to these stories for a long time. Has nothing at all resonated with you to make you feel the need to remedy a specific issue? Did nothing, basically, to put it in a more classic terminology, jump up and bite you in the ass and say, oh my goodness, this is very wrong. I must do something. Mm-hmm. So I would challenge people. I would tell them, I'm not going to tell you what to do. Okay, however, you would find that people would be confused because it is a big uncharted land for some people. I'd say, okay, how many of you have gone down to City Hall and advocated for affordable housing? How many of you went down to TriMet and advocated for more bus routes in East Portland? How many of you called up Portland Public Schools and said, why are you closing Jefferson High School? And when I would start breaking it down so they'd understand that there are certain policies and practices at every level of municipality, from city through county through state, that they could affect, then people started having the lights go on. Because a lot of times people thought of it more in a personal sense. Mm-hmm. They didn't recognize how the overarching system of racism has the laws and practices and policies buttress it, you know, that structure. So I would have to encourage people, okay, this is what you have to do. You have to look at this, and what about this offends your sensibilities as a human being? Mm-hmm. Then that's where you get busy. I think for some folks, though, to recognize that they had to give up something to make this work was another challenge, because basically, and remind me if I said this right, I would ask people, what are you prepared to give up to make the changes that you know needs to happen? And I think that would scare a lot of people, because the whole concept of white privilege is not that you yourself are doing something bad, but you have to look at, are you still continuing to go to the bank of unearned privilege and cash your check, which really belongs to all of us and not just one particular group? Because if you continue to cash that check,
then you are benefiting at my expense or any other mm-hmm. person of color's expense in this city. Some people really did get it.
Yes. You know, working together to identify ourselves as people who are going to work toward a more equitable city, recognizing what real allyship consists of. And mm-hmm. I have a few things I've figured out to do from listening. But here's something I want to point out is shop at Black-owned businesses that are left in this neighborhood. There are many fewer than there were. Go into Reflections next time you need a coffee. In my experience, when I first walked in there, was getting a look like, did you get lost? You know, I just kept going back. And Gloria can order books for you. So you support a Black-owned business. Also, I think, learn more. One of the things I found that has been the most challenging, have these conversations with your white friends. There's a great film called Local Color that was made, now it's 25 years ago, mm-hmm. about the history. Who knew there was a thriving Black business district downtown?
Downtown on Broadway.
Then thriving Black business district and neighborhood where now the Coliseum sits. This is a history of Oregon and of Portland that is really revealing. You can get it at the library. You can get it from OPB. Invite mm-hmm. your friends over and say, let's watch this film and talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's really simple. Get the conversation going.
Here's a really pointed one. How many of you know that they're doing a revisioning for Dawson Park? How many of you know why that beautiful kind of Byzantine structure is in the middle of the park, that big onion dome? That structure was on top of a drugstore here in Portland in the Black community. When that part was moved on, that dome was captured and put into Dawson Park. Well, the city is now asking how to use it because, well, the neighborhood has changed. And you got to look out first. Politically correct language sometimes is code language. Be aware when you hear stuff like that, that means make sure that it is open to everyone and it's going to be a fair forum, and invite the people that you know have lived here in the neighborhood for a while who may not be plugged in anymore to be a part of that. Because just because we say the neighborhood has changed doesn't mean that means now you can kick out the old Black men who go over there and play checkers every day. Because to them, the neighborhood works fine. What do you mean we need to change it because it's changed? I still live here. What are you talking about? So make sure that it is a big, broad venture and not something that is focused on small segments of who we are. We're bigger than that.
Thank you so much, Judith Celeste. Thank you.
Thanks to Celeste Carey, Judith Mowry, Arlie Summer, The Dill Pickle Club, Nani Kaz, Pastor Don Frazier, and the Flying Focus Video Collective.
The Restorative Listening Project is on summer break, but will return in the fall. For more information, go to facebook.com and search for Restorative Listening Project on Gentrification, or go to portlandonline.com and search for Restorative Listening.
Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. We can be heard the first and third Wednesdays here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. You can contact us through kboo.fm/circlearadio, where you can also listen to past programs. Or you can contact us at circlearadio@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.